the Big Blue Kickoff live on this Thursday afternoon. John Schmelk and Lance Meadow with you. A special edition, three interviews today. We usually take your calls. Today we will not. We'll do a couple of game previews. But first, our big interview off the top is former Giants general manager Ernie Accorsi. And Ernie found out earlier this week that he'll be heading into the Giants Ring of Honor at MetLife Stadium in a ceremony taking place on November 14th. Monday night against the Bengals, and he joins us on Big Blue Kickoff Live today. Ernie, John Schmelk, Lance Meadow here in East Rutherford. Thanks so much for joining us, and congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be on with you.
What does it mean to have your name up there with all those other Giants legends in the Ring of Honor?
It's overwhelming. I've been in a lot of stadiums over the years where they have these Rings of Honor, and mostly they're players. In fact, they're almost all players and coaches. I never even dreamed that I would ever be up there, let alone with this franchise. And, you know, I agree with Tuck and Coughlin when they said this is the best organization in sports. I always tell the young guys that I worked with the Giants, I said, I'm fortunate that my last job was with this organization. If you guys don't stay with them, you're going to find out there is no other organization like this one. And it's just, you know, it's a great honor. I mean, I'm a pretty old guy, and I grew up following sports starting in the 50s and saw this team the first time in 1952. So to be able to have my name up there with such great people like Frank Gifford and Charles Connolly and Lawrence Taylor, it's overwhelming to me.
Ernie, as you mentioned, you've been part of a few organizations throughout the course of your career, and what's unique about the Giants is, you know, they do such a good job of recognizing their history and emphasizing that, and, you know, the fact that you're going to be the second general manager in franchise history to be in the Ring of Honor, along with one of the guys that you worked under in George Young. I mean, how does that really put things in perspective in terms of your career?
Well, that, you know, it's extra special to be up there with George because we first met. He joined the Baltimore Colts in 69. I joined in 1970. We were both making $14,000 a year. And he was a scout. I was a PR director, although we all scouted because we only had five people in the organization. Even the equipment manager scouted. But to have started with him and have been so close to him over the years, and to be one of two general managers in this franchise's history, where both of us got our starts with the Colts. And you're right about the history. I mean, there's the continuity is Wellington Mara's father, John Mara's grandfather, started this franchise in 1925. And then it went to Wellington and then to John. And there's been a great partnership with the Tisch family since 1990. I mean, it hasn't changed hands. And the other two franchises I worked with were both historical, the Baltimore Colts and the Cleveland Browns, but they both moved. You know, there is no Baltimore Colts anymore. There's the Cleveland Browns, but it's not the same franchise. So this one just is, you know, it's the flagship franchise. And I always felt that way. And, you know, even when I didn't work here and really didn't have a lot of hope that I ever would, but to be to work here is a privilege, to be recognized like this. You know, it's I didn't dream that dream. I mean, I wouldn't let myself dream that dream. So it's really a wonderful moment for me.
We're joined by Ernie Accorsi right here on Big Blue Kickoff Live on Giants.com. And Ernie, you talked about the continuity. So does it really make it almost fitting that the two guys going into the Ring of Honor the same year you are two guys that you had a hand in bringing to the Giants and really helped carry through the legacy that you put together as general manager, putting those two Super Bowl championships together?
That makes it even better. There's so many parts of this that are just terrific, and that makes it even better. I exchanged emails or texts with Tom Coughlin yesterday, and I said to him, did you ever think when we sat at the Newark Airport Marriott in 2004, that winter, when we interviewed John Mara and I interviewed him, that it would come to this? I mean, you know, you hope it's going to come to this, but he hadn't won a championship yet, and I hadn't either. I mean, I had as a PR director, but not as a general manager. So, Tuck was such a great pick for us because, you know, the only reason he was available when he was available is because he was injured and he played hurt. He was a first-round player. And so to be involved, you know, to go in with them, it makes it even better.
Talking with former Giants general manager Ernie Accorsi here on Big Blue Kickoff Live on Giants.com. You talked about that meeting that you had with Tom Coughlin, Ernie, and when you look at his career overall with the New York Giants, I think what's interesting is when you first brought him in as a head coach, you know, his resume, his reputation, the way he interacted with the media, and then at the end of his career, you know, how much really he changed and evolved as a head coach. You know, talk about what you observed both when you were within the organization and from afar, and how impressed you are with how Tom really changed his overall approach to coaching during his tenure with the Giants.
Well, first of all, and I think this is the most important thing, he's a great man. He's got integrity. He's a family man. He's a religious man. So he's a good person. Secondly, he caught my eye. I didn't know much about him when he was an assistant coach. I saw one of his first games at Boston College when he almost beat Michigan. It's the day I saw Tyrone Wheatley, who made and Desmond Howard had to return a kickoff to beat him. And he didn't really have an abundance of talent. And I watched the job he did as a head coach there. And of course, he took Jacksonville to the brink of a championship awful fast. So I knew he could coach. But the interesting thing, and you'll remember this, when we hired him, there was a lot of criticism, and you know, from some quarters that, oh, you're never going to get any players in free agency. No one will come here and play for him. And I will tell you this: we never really lost a free agent we really wanted. So in his era. So it didn't happen, and I, you know, players that want to win are going to want to play for a guy like that because he's a winner. He's demanding. Players want to win. They want the discipline. So, yeah, he did. You know, after I left, I mean, I guess I wasn't there, so I'm no expert on everything. But you know, he evolved, and I mean, Belichick changed. I hired Belichick, and you know, and things didn't work out in Cleveland right away. Although I think they would have if they wouldn't have been in all that turmoil of the move. I think he's just going to win no matter where he goes. But he adapted, he changed, and, you know, the great ones will do that. The ones that don't succeed keep making the same mistakes. And I think that's one of the, you know, the great joys of Tom Coughlin. He's smart, and he revised, but he didn't change his principles. He didn't change his basic fundamentals.
You know, Ernie, you came in, you succeeded George Young in 1998. You had Danny Cannell as your starting quarterback, and I guess really the first super big decision you had to make was a decision to bring in Kerry Collins, which obviously eventually paid dividends. It got the Giants to that Super Bowl a couple years later. Can you take us through what that decision-making process was like for you, deciding that Kerry Collins was a good fit for the Giants, given everything that had gone on with him in Carolina?
Yes, first of all, you know, I have a lot of people share this, but when I first came into the league, Johnny Unitas was the quarterback that I was involved with. Now, so I was spoiled for life. And I also knew, as that team evolved from being world champions in the late 50s, the one that played the Giants in the sudden death game, to not quite as good a team, although we won the Super Bowl in 70, it wasn't as talented as supporting cast, but we always had him. And what I learned is that when you have a great quarterback, you always have a chance. And I always defined leadership is looking on the team bus on the road when you always have a few more butterflies than you do at home and seeing that guy, and you know he's on our side, he's got a chance. So when I inherited the job, Danny Cannell was a fine quarterback, but I've always believed that position is the most important position in sports, and, you know, there wasn't one available in the draft. We couldn't just go draft one. And when he became available, what we did with our organization is we went back to all our reports that we had when he came out. I also had an advantage that I had worked for Paterno, and I trusted the Penn State people. And there were mostly the coaches that were there when we signed Kerry had coached him. And I knew he had solid character. He went off the track, but I knew that his background, he's from Lebanon, Pennsylvania, which was 10 miles from where I grew up. So I had contacts all through there, and I remember when Bill Pennington did this huge takeout piece in the Times on him, he told me he went back there, talked to his high school coach, his junior high school coach. He said, everybody I talked to said that you had already talked to them. I mean, we really researched it, and we felt that he had the character, that he was going to be fine. And I told him when I interviewed him, I said, you're going to find that the Giants organization is the closest thing you'll ever come to Penn State. It's professional football. It's not collegiate football. But this is a family here. And that's the way it's run. And you'll get all the support measures you need, but you're going to have to do it yourself. We never had a problem with him. He played well. He got us to the Super Bowl. But I still felt that we had to reach for greatness if we could. And I talked to Jerry Reese. There were rumors that Eli was going to come out his junior year. And I went down to see him against Auburn. And I came, and he didn't come out. But when I wrote that report now that's gone viral, and I essentially thought we can win a championship with this guy. And when he did come out, I really, you know, the fortunate thing for us is that we had that year in 2003 to put us in fourth spot. If I wouldn't have been in the fourth spot, we wouldn't have gotten him. We would have had to go too far to get him. Now, you know, I would have been satisfied with Roethlisberger. I felt very, really good about Roethlisberger. And all our scouts did, Tom did, the Maras did. We felt real solid about Roethlisberger, but I just, and they're about as close as you can get as far as what they've done. But it was just something about Eli that he was the one I wanted, but I didn't really expect to get him at that point because it looked like they weren't going to trade him. Or they were asking for OC Udom and Euro, which we were not going to give him. So that's how the whole thing evolved, because I just felt that with the quarterback, you have to reach for greatness if you have a chance.
Well, you just mentioned a lot about that 2004 quarterback class, Ernie, and Phillip Rivers, who obviously was part of the Eli Manning trade. And it's interesting because now when we look back, we tend to put that class in perspective. A lot of people who want to debate which quarterback class is the greatest bring in the 83 class too, which you also have ties to. Now, on the subject of trying to coordinate a trade with A.J. Smith, who was the Chargers general manager at the time, your experience dealing with John Elway and what happened in 83 with the Colts, how much did that help in terms of orchestrating the deal and understanding perhaps what San Diego was going through with Eli Manning?
Well, I didn't know AJ. I walked up to him at the league meetings in March, and it already kind of surfaced that Eli didn't want to play out there. And I went up to him and introduced myself. I said, look, we're fourth. I went through this. It was a little different because Elway had this baseball leverage that I never believed in, because I had a scouting report, and you know he was a prospect, but he was going to play football, and I said, but if you want to see this through, and don't flinch at this, I'm all for it because I did it, and I defied the odds, I faced all the protests, I did it, so God bless you if that's what you're going to do, but if you want to trade him, we're interested. Now, I only spoke to him three or four times after that, but the interesting thing about that is when you can't pick a player for another team, that's not allowed by the league. So if I called the league before I drafted Rivers, we were going to draft Roethlisberger, and AJ called me 7 minutes into our 15-minute allotment. Had we jumped and drafted Roethlisberger, that would have been the end of it because he didn't want Roethlisberger, he wanted Rivers. But if I would have called the league and said, look, will you certify this trade? I'm going to pick Rivers, but I'm going to trade him. They would have said no. If you pick Rivers and he backs out of the trade, you have Rivers. Now, I like Rivers, but that was a big risk by us because we were picking Roethlisberger. So when AJ called, he asked for OC again. I said no, and then he said, would you give me next year's number one? I said yes, because we had already discussed that. But I said, who do you want? And he said, Rivers. I held my breath. Okay? Because he could have backed out and the league would have backed him. Because the league would not accept that. You're not allowed to do that. I mean, I didn't break any rule, but you're not allowed to get approved by the league in advance. So
right, yeah.
I held my breath. And then, Joel Busser talked to both of us. Our terms agreed. They were consistent. And he accepted it even before the computer message got in. But that certified it.
Wow, that's amazing. And it's, yeah. That has to be a level of trust there between general managers and organizations. And the funny thing is, general managers hate trading draft picks. They don't like trading ones. It really puts you in a bind in next year. But ironically, you trade the number one from 2005 to get Eli, and then the 2005 draft class turns out, quite frankly, to be a fantastic draft class for the New York Football Giants. You bring in
I know, and that,
Webster,
and
Tuck,
amazing.
And Brandon Jacobs. It's amazing.
Well, we had four picks, you know, and actually the fourth pick was a defensive lineman who was a pretty good player. We were trying to keep him, but I was in the back of a elevator coming down. You know, the stadium changed where when you left the press box, you were in the with the suite holders,
right?
And we were getting bombed by the Packers the first year I was retired, and the people didn't recognize me. I was in the back of the elevator, and I heard these guys talking about, this was before that year. This was before this was Eli's rookie year. I heard him saying, "Now we only have four picks next year, and now this quarterback's a bust." And I was shrinking against them. I mean, I was thinking, "Please don't turn around, because I don't want to face the music."
Oh, man.
And I ran from my car when I got out of that. But that was I was actually during Eli's rookie year when we were losing. And,
yeah.
And so, yeah, but that turned out to be, I mean, I think that those three guys are indispensable to our titles. I don't know that we would have won without those three guys.
Absolutely.
Talking with former Giants general manager Ernie Accorsi here on Big Blue Kickoff Live. He'll be inducted into the Giants Ring of Honor, the second general manager. That'll come week 10 when the Giants host the Bengals on Monday Night Football. And the exact date is November 14th, so certainly stay tuned for that with Tom Coughlin and Justin Tuck. You mentioned that 2005 draft class, Ernie, and you also mentioned earlier that during the Tom Coughlin era, you didn't miss out any of free agency in terms of when you pursued some of the notable players. And when I look at the players you brought in, I think Antonio Pierce really, to me, jumps off the page, especially with what he provided for the team and helping them win Super Bowls, but also the leadership he brought to the locker room. What was the rationale in targeting Antonio Pierce? And when you look back at what ultimately his career became with the Giants, how impressed are you in terms of with the results?
See, I agree with you completely. His leadership, I mean, he was everything you wanted. He wasn't a holler guy, but one of the keys to that signing was Marty Schottenheimer. He had coached 1 year for the Redskins, and he played him outside, and he got fired. And, you know, we liked Pierce. Dave Gettleman was incredible as a pro personnel director. To me, he didn't make one mistake in evaluations while I was there. And we talked about him, but we wanted a guy to play the middle. And I called Marty, and I asked him about it. He said, and I didn't even ask him. He said to me, "I made a mistake with him. I should have played him in the middle." He said, "He was good outside. He has a chance to be an outstanding middle linebacker." And I trusted Marty because I had worked with Marty. And that was the rationale. I agree with you. I thought that he and Plexico were the huge signings. And where Plexico, you know, we needed Eli to have somebody he could go to and get out of trouble. Where he was rushed, he could just throw it downfield, and he was like a rebounder. And he could out-jump people and had great hands. And I knew we had to get a great receiver. Toomer was terrific. Hilliard was terrific. But we needed to get a big play receiver who could make the errant throw into a big play. So those two were huge to us. And the leadership of Antonio, though, I agree. He was such a quiet leader. And, you know, I remember sitting with him on a Saturday before the Super Bowl in Arizona, just the two of us, and then Armstead came up and sat down with us. And Armstead said something to him, "How do you feel?" He said, "I'm starting to get nervous." This was the day before the game. And he said, "But all I'm going to do is go over my assignments and just study my assignments again tonight and try to stay within myself." And of course, you know, the rest is history from that game.
You know, Ernie, it's funny. You talk about two of those big free agent additions in Pierce and Plaxico, but I think the key to these championships sometimes is figuring out a way to acquire talent without using premium resources. And I think the way you guys put together that offensive line that was so important to that run. Yeah, Kareem McKenzie was a relatively big free agent addition, used a high draft pick on Chris Knee, but finding Richie Seibert, finding Sean O'Hara, finding David Deal, and that unit just working so well together. I think that group and the way you put them together was as indispensable as anybody else on that roster putting that run together.
I agree. And those are, listen, if we'd been protect Eli, we wouldn't have won. And that line was okay for a while and got great. And Flaherty did a great job with that line. But you're right, Sean O'Hara was a great signing. Soybert coming back from his injuries. David Deal, you know, when we drafted him, we thought probably play guard, maybe play right tackle. They had the courage to play him at left tackle. Yeah. We won two Super Bowls with a guy at left tackle. I always learned, be careful and don't over-evaluate individuals in the offensive line because they're like a fist. If you make a fist and you take one of the fingers out, you're not going to be able to be as effective no matter what you do. They have to work together as a unit. And, boy, that line was – they were tough mentally and physically, and they worked together, and they were – I mean, they were like glue. They were so close. You're right. The one pedigree was Chris Snee. We knew he was. But it was such a combination of different personalities and different levels of talent. But as a unit, they played great together.
When it comes to scouting players for the draft as well as free agency, as you noted throughout this interview, Ernie, you need a team of people. And, you know, the Giants have a track record. You were going over the history earlier in the program in terms of ownership and growing people within. You know, two individuals in particular that served under you, Dave Gettleman, who you referenced earlier, and Jerry Reese, who ultimately succeeded you as Giants general manager. When you look at what they've accomplished after you groom them, Gettleman going on to helping the Panthers get to the most recent Super Bowl, Jerry Reese, the two Super Bowls in 07 and 11. Now, how meaningful is that for you personally when you've worked alongside those two individuals, you help get them opportunities, and then you see how they took what they learned under you and ultimately applied that moving forward?
Well, and it's really interesting, the evolution of both of those two guys. And I've said that to both of them that I just said it to Dave last year when we went to the Super Bowl. This sounds like a phony statement. I was as happy for Gettleman as I would have been for myself. I felt the same thing about Jerry. Jerry was an area scout in Tennessee. I saw very quickly in the draft that, just as a scout, I thought he was our best scout. And when Tim Rooney abruptly retired, I was really shocked that he was my age, and I wasn't, you know, he was able to retire. He had worked at Villanova when I was at St. Joe's, and when he came in, he said, "I'm going to retire." I said, "One thing's for sure, the Augustinian order paid better than the Jesuits." I said, "How can you afford to retire? You're 59. So, but anyway, when that happened, we elevated Gettleman from assistant to the number one job, and I called Jerry and I said, "I want you to come up here because I want you to be the assistant pro guy." And he came up, and the first thing he got was sticker shock. He saw the prices of houses. Now, he had a beautiful house in rural Tennessee, and, you know, I was afraid he wasn't going to take it. I said, "You have to take this job. You're going to be a general manager someday, but you're not going to be a general manager if you continue to stay as an area scout. You got to come back into the office. You got to be able to dress up, come in, learn the disciplines and structure of the office. You got to get here. Follow the job. The money will catch up." And thankfully, he took it. So then when Marv left, I made him player personnel director. So we had the two of them there. But I also don't want to overlook the fact that if you look at that scouting staff, there's been very, very little turnover. Yeah. Because they've stayed there. Of course, it's a great organization to work for. They've been good scouts. We've kept them. Our scouts were fantastic. People retire like Jerry Shea, but people don't leave. And I remember when I took over, there was a guy named Joe Collins that was with the 49ers, then he went to the Browns.
He's still here, Ernie.
My point is that he had all that experience with Bill Walsh. And it's interesting, he made a report in 1980 as a Blesto scout, and it was the Blesto meetings were in Baltimore, and he gave his reports and then left because he was joining the Jets. And I said to myself, I'm going to hire that guy someday. And I always watched him. And when I hired him, he said, "What do you want from me?" I said, "Well, I want you to be a great scout." I said, "But I want a man in that draft room, because we had so many young kids in there because we expanded our scouting staff." I said, "Well, I want a leader in there. I want a guy that they can look up to." And boy, he was that. And, you know, when things got kind of out, you know, how they will in debates and in the draft room and meetings, not the day of the draft, but I'm talking about as you prepare, he put things in order pretty quickly. And there's a perfect example where we didn't go outside very often. We trained our own scouts, but when we did go outside for somebody like him, it was a 10-strike.
Hollywood is great. We love him. I always talk to him when we go out to the combine, and he is a amount of football knowledge that you need books to put on paper. He's unbelievable. We're joined by Ernie Accorsi, former Giants general manager. Two more quickies, Ernie, before we say goodbye. Thank you so much for being patient with your time here. A couple of the Super Bowls you had your fingerprints on. You know, you take a look back, and I don't want to bring up a sore subject, but you look at the Super Bowl against the Ravens, you look at the score, and you say, wow, you know, domination, it looked like a blowout. But when you go back and you look at that game, the final score, irregardless, that really seemed to me a game that the Giants were in and competitive in and had a real shot in, despite what the final score might have looked like at the end of the game. Do you agree?
Absolutely, and I tell you why. If they don't call Armstead's touchdown back, we're in the game.
Keith Hamilton holding penalty.
a phantom call, which they never make, and let alone in the Super Bowl. But I'll tell you why I believe that, and I don't mean to demean Dilfer. He won, okay, but they didn't even keep him. When I was in my first Super Bowl, Super Bowl V, the only reason we won that game is because Craig Morton gave it to us. I mean, we got to the goal line twice on four plays and could not get in. He comes right back and throws an interception. And the fact is that that could have happened to Dilfer if that interception would have been returned for a touchdown. Because John Fox told me the week of the game, he said, you know, that he had already told me we're going to shut out Minnesota, which I thought he was nuts when he told me that, because they scored about 1,000 points in my dreams during the night of that week.
Oh, they were good.
Yeah, exactly. But he said to me, we're going to shut these people out. I mean, you know, they didn't have much of it. They couldn't score. If we would have, you know, it would have put a lot of pressure on Dell for the rest of that game. But I will tell you the one thing I learned, a great lesson in that Super Bowl. We weren't good enough. And I knew that the one thing that we had to do is reach for greatness at quarterback, but we had to get a better pass rush. And those are the two things. You're not going to win championships without those two things. You might get lucky like they did that year, because they say lucky, it's one of the greatest defenses in history. But, you know, we threw five interceptions. And I knew that when I looked at that team, we weren't good enough. We had to get better than that. And that's how you learn in this business. You don't kid yourself into thinking, oh, we could have won this game. Well, yeah, we could have. We could have stolen it, but we didn't. But I don't want to steal it. I want to be good enough to win in our own right.
Well, and you followed through with those core principles, Ernie. You got Eli Manning and then the likes of Justin Tuck and O.C. Umanure to help with the pass rush. So the core that you ultimately helped build goes on to win Super Bowls in 07 and 11 after seeing what transpired in that previous Super Bowl and then seeing what you built and them achieving greatness. You know, how meaningful, how special was it to then watch to see what this group ultimately accomplished?
It was fabulous. I mean, it was a, you know, I can't even explain how I felt that at that Arizona Super Bowl. I sat with my son, who was a coach. My oldest son coached it. He was a GA at Virginia, and then he was a full-time coach at Maryland. And when we got the ball on the last drive, you know, and I've said this before, I was hoping he was going to take us for a touchdown. The second Super Bowl, I felt they're not going to stop us. I didn't feel as confident the first time, but I said to my son, I said, well, if Eli's what we thought he was, he does it right now. This is when you have to do it. This is when Unitas did it. Not October 15th, now. And he did. He did. I mean, it was really hard to explain the feeling I had when he hit. And I give Coughlin so much credit, because in the back of my mind, I thought playoff substitutes in the last regular season game. Don't take any chance of getting anybody hurt. He played that game to win, and I am convinced that team came out of that game thinking they're not that good. We can beat them. I'm convinced of it. And Coughlin was right, 100% right on that. And by playing them tough, we weren't afraid of them when we got into the Super Bowl.
And Ernie, finally, final question, and again, thanks so much for joining us. People forget, and I'm sure it's going to be lost to history, but if you were in this city in the middle of 2007, after that Minnesota Viking game, I believe it was at the end of November, I mean, half this town wanted to run Eli Manning out on a train and get him out of town. And, you know, if he doesn't have that last drive against the Patriots, the Giants only scored 10 points in the Super Bowl. I'm sure people will forget then the unbelievable performance he had against the Packers the previous week. You know, just that drive, you know, really cemented Eli Manning's status as the future franchise quarterback of the Giants to where he is today. And I think people will forget, you know, how tenuous it really was at times during that 2007 season.
Well, I'll tell you this. I was at that Viking game, and you know, he threw an interception, and I left. By the time I got to the car, he had thrown another one. By the time I got to the Lincoln Tunnel, he threw another one. And when I came out of the Lincoln Tunnel, he threw another one. I mean, I wanted to just hide somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, but it's interesting. You know, one of the first lessons I learned from a guy named Milt Davis, he died a few years ago, was one of his scouts in Baltimore. I had not seen Unitas because I was at Penn State for 2 years. I hadn't seen him in person, and he had torn all the tendons in his elbow. And he was throwing softballs in training camp, and I, you know, what did I know? I was a rookie, and I said, can we win with him? And he said, remember one thing, Ernest. You evaluate a quarterback with his ability to take a team down the field in the championship game with the title on the line and into the end zone. That's how you evaluate a quarterback. And, you know, you can throw interceptions, you can do whatever. If you can do that, then you're going to be a championship quarterback.
And Eli Manning certainly
indeed
proved that he is on more than one occasion. Ernie, thanks so much. We appreciate the time, and we look forward to seeing you at the stadium on November 14th when you're inducted into the Giants Ring of Honor on Monday Night Football along with Tom Coughlin and Justin Tuck. Congratulations again, and we'll talk to you down the road. Okay?
Congrats, Ernie.
Well,
thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, guys. I enjoyed it.